Good evening. How are we all doing tonight? And stop it.
Stop it. Okay.
Stop it.
During 1960, the post-war era of careless confidence came to an end. There had, of course, in the past been international crises aplenty. By and large, American life remained abundant, the spirit of America euphoric. During the last 12 months, cruel reality finally forced America wide awake. Anxiety usually begins in the pocketbook. This was true of America in 1960. It had no name, but it was certain and it was present. There was a downturn throughout 1960 of the economic indices and the economic cycles. The second major post-war recession was upon us. There were no bread lines in 1960. The stock market did not panic. By the end of the year, unemployment had risen to a level of 6% of the total laboring force. On the year, steel production had not reached 50% of capacity. And each passing week, new communities were added to the rolls of the distressed area federal list. And most sobering of all was the outflow of our gold reserves, beginning as a trickle early in the year, growing to a flood of many millions of dollars each week. Here was silent but irrefutable evidence that the financial centers of the world no longer looked to the American economy as a symbol of soundness, no longer regarded our currency as the acme of stability. And Secretary Anderson, hat in hand, in November, made a tour of NATO capitals, seeking to get these governments to take on added financial responsibility for the costs of Western Europe armaments. Post-war era of open-handed American largesse was at end. And when these countries, most of whom owed their prosperity, if not their existence, to American generosity, when these countries turned down out of hand Secretary Anderson's requests, it became evident to Americans that they would have to look to their own economic knitting, and that, financially at least, charity from now on would have to begin at home. As the new year began, it was hard to discern the economic road ahead. But there were many signs of important, even radical changes. We would have to retrench in our military offshore purchasing program. We would have to limit our fiscal commitments overseas. We would have to encourage a pool of capital from which to give to the underdeveloped nations of the world rather than to attempt their improvement single-handed. We would have to increase government subsidy and government projects in our own distressed areas. We would have to curb American investment abroad when such investment was to the detriment of our own economy. Long-range, careful, sober planning would be necessary keep the American economy at its present high level of prosperity. The challenge of automation, the weight of overproduction, the competition of low-cost economies, which were in many cases being subsidized by our own dollars, the high level of chronic unemployment, these were sobering signs and challenges which a new administration in the new year would have to meet. If anxiety begins in the pocket, it is multiplied by evidence seen about us in our daily lives of challenge and crisis. And if domestically there were few crises There was much evidence that all was not well on the American domestic scene. Throughout the fall, we had the sickening evidence of the New Orleans school impasse, disheartening as testimony to primitive human emotion, brutality, hatred, and ignorance. But most disheartening is evidence that sober, capable leadership was lacking nationally and locally, which might force this situation to a sensible conclusion. America had in the past several years been sweeping its domestic problems under the rug. Out of sight was out of mind. And throughout the year, there was evidence that we would have to confront these domestic problems realistically and take sometimes dramatic action to correct them. There was a scandal of the migrant farm worker. Low wages, bad housing, minimal education, little protection under the law. There was a crisis of our public school systems. Our public school systems had nobly and valiantly fought to build to accommodate the population bulge. There was increasing evidence that with the increased costs of personnel, they would no longer be able to keep pace with the population explosion and with the increasingly expensive demands of more developed training necessary in the technological age unless large-scale federal aid was made available to them. Medical science was increasingly making it a statistical probability that many of our people would reach old age. But as yet there was no broad program for medical and geriatric care for these people, many of whom were living on radically reduced retirement incomes. Delinquency was on the rise. Alcoholism was on the rise. Addiction was on the rise. Crime was on the rise. There were less social agencies and social workers to care for the population per capita in 1960 than in 1950. All these problems were well known, but except in certain dramatic local instances, there was no broad overall plan to develop the preventative and the therapeutic and the care and the correctional institutions and measures required to keep the American people as a people healthy, strong, and sound. Both parties in June of this year recognized the importance and the necessity of new social welfare legislation. Both parties wrote into their planks important social welfare platforms. But in July and August of this year, in the hastily and perhaps unwisely convened rump session of Congress, each of these issues became in its turn a political football, and nothing was accomplished. In November of this year, the American people voted for such programs. By the end of the year, it was increasingly clear that the traditional enemies of such legislation were massing their counterattack, that the budgetary and fiscal problems and the domestic and military needs of the country would take priority in the new session of Congress, and unless there was strong executive leadership, each of these issues would again be swept out of sight and out of mind, without thought to the human agony, the human equation involved. But surely if Robert Kennedy, during the height of a campaign, could go to Atlanta to secure the release of Martin Luther King, as surely John Kennedy, as President of the United States, could compel in his way, directly or indirectly, the officials of the state of Louisiana to release the necessary school monies. And surely if John Kennedy, the campaigner, could enthusiastically endorse his plank of social welfare, and John Kennedy, the President, had the moral obligation to himself, to his words, and to his people, to secure the enactment of these programs into law. During 1960, domestic indecision, fiscal suspicion and danger and weakness, combined with a grim and menacing international situation. Who of us will forget the Tokyo photograph Press Secretary Haggerty being lifted up bodily through the roof of his car by a helicopter, much as we might lift a sardine from a can with a fork, to save him from a Yankee go home chanting mob of Japanese demonstrators. From Seoul to Tokyo, from Cairo to Leopoldville, from Havana to Caracas, demonstrating mobs, wild mobs, violent mobs, cried out, hatred of America, Yankee, no. If America did not deserve this opprobrium, and certainly we did not in most cases, surely it was evidence that we had succeeded in the last decade in projecting abroad a caricature, a vicious, unfortunate caricature of ourselves. Equally certainly, we would need to rectify that picture in the eyes of the world. The trip of President Eisenhower to the Far East was indicative of the sinking state of our national prestige. Conceived as a goodwill tour, it became a personal ordeal carried out only to save the country's honor. But if Americans could dismiss these semi-literate and highly volatile Asian and African mobs, it's hardly cause for concern. They could not dismiss the sobering fact that in 1960, for the first time, the Cold War washed up against our own shores. In 1960, Panama, Guatemala, Venezuela, Ecuador, and Cuba became cockpits of the East-West controversy as surely as Berlin, Egypt, Indochina. A half century of American incompetence and economic selfishness, and 2.5 years of American indignation, and Cuban irresponsibility, and Russian meddling had raised the Castro Revolution into something far more menacing than the overthrow of a local dictator. Castro has come to play in the Caribbean the same revolution-peddling role that Nasser plays throughout the Near East and Africa. And the wine that he seeks to pour for the underprivileged and undernourished and semi-literate peoples of this area is a heady wine indeed. Bottled in Cuba, but made of a witch's brew of public education, land reform, trade unionism, equal law, and social democracy. And if America had reason to fear the Castro-branded revolutions, as radical, as neutralist, as endangering perhaps the security of the Western Hemisphere, as led by volatile men whose ambition sometimes took precedence over their principles, America could not escape this salient fact. These revolutions were the certain future south of our border. And if we were not to find ourselves isolated in our own backyard, then surely we would have to find a way to speak again to the revolutionists, to make them understand that we empathize with their grievances, that we understand their ambitions, and that we are at one with them in their ultimate aims. America must learn to export enthusiasm for its Constitution as eagerly as we have exported enthusiasm for the fiscal profits of our giant corporations. The Cold War, which washed up during 1960 against the North American shores, was an embittered war, a war of new acerbity and violence. And this was in many ways surprising, because 1960 began in high hope and expectancy. The spirit of Camp David was in the air. Mr. Eisenhower and Mr. Khrushchev had spoken long and had reached apparent understanding in September of 1959 during Mr. Khrushchev's visit to the United States, and the world looked forward to the warming sun of a Parisian May to write chapter and verse to new international understanding. But on May 1st, 15 days before the opening of that conference, as Francis Powers and the U-2 plummeted out of a Russian sky, all hope for any arrangement in Paris went up in a puff of smoke. Mr. Khrushchev, who had staked his political future on the necessity of coexistence with the West, who had at ideological conferences with the communist nations fought Chou En-lai to a theoretical standstill on the necessity of reinterpreting Marxian doctrine, the same Mr. Khrushchev reacted with all the anger and all the truculence of a wounded Russian bear. The old line Marxists and Stalinists in the Kremlin must have rubbed salt into his wounds. And he came to Paris in a bitter mood. And he showed at Paris all the peasant cruelty and boorishness of which he was capable. At Paris, Khrushchev, by his anger and his angry, unforgivable words, trampled into the dust any hope of international arrangement. But Mr. Khrushchev's personal actions, however reprehensible they were, does not utterly excuse American policy. A serious question must be raised as to the legitimacy of ordering this U-2 flight at such a fragile moment in international relationships. And Mr. Eisenhower's apparent ignorance of this flight raises serious question as to the unanimity of agreement within our own government as to the advisability of high-level understanding. Our original denial of the U-2 incidents was tactless and was thoughtless. Our subsequent about-face was done in bad grace. Our subsequent attempt to justify the mission was needlessly provocative. Finally, our attempt to impugn the loyalty and the honor and the courage of Powers was utterly contemptible. Our hands are not clean. Blame for the debacle at Paris. And far more than any incident of the past decade, failure of the Paris conference plunged the world into a more menacing international situation than it had known since the close of the Second World War. For after Paris, Laos, Algeria, the Congo, threat to the United Nations were almost inevitable. There would be no communication between Washington and Moscow. It was to be only angry words backed by angry, often ill-conceived deeds. It was inevitable after Paris that the East-West would arrive at no agreement to isolate the newly liberated nations of Central Africa from the Cold War. There had been hope to this point that Russia and the United States might agree to an arms embargo in this area, to give this area time to develop, to grow, to educate its people, to come alive to the 18th century even, much less to the 20th. The Congo crisis began not in Leopoldville, but in Paris. And Mobutu and Kasabubu and Lumumba would have remained unknown, unheard of, squabbling Congolese officials if after Paris it had not been necessary for the two great powers to find pawns for their ulterior purposes. Paris made it certain that the 19 new nations of Central Africa would find themselves thrust to the forefront of the Cold War. The prizes were worth the gamble. Here was a mineral-rich, population-poor, fertile area. Here was a vacuum area open to exploitation from east and from west. It is only after Paris also that the Russians and the Chinese began to interfere actively in the Algerian problem, to support by arms the FLN insurgents, to make it impossible for Mr. de Gaulle to win independence for Algeria, consonant with honor and with economic stability for France. Before Paris, the United Nations had looked hopefully towards establishing a United Nations order in Central Africa. They had hoped that all economic aid would be channeled through some central pool. Dag Hammarskjöld was prepared to send United Nations officials at all levels of government, engineers and teachers and public officials, into these areas until the people were sufficiently educated to govern themselves. There were high hopes and great plans. But the failure of the Paris conference destroyed all of these. And the Congo was inevitable, and the Congo is only one of 1,000 tinderboxes in Central Africa, each of which has enough inflammable material in it to plunge the world into Holocaust. Paris made it inevitable that the whole structure of the United Nations would come up for attack. Mr. Hammarskjöld had made it clear that the United Nations was to be the central power in this new African situation, that through the United Nations, stability and order could be brought to this area. He had so conceived his administration as to have developed programs and officials consonant with the needs. But Mr. Khrushchev, angered and embittered, came to New York in November of this year and at the General Assembly meeting in a fist-pounding declaration of impudence and arrogance, personally attacked Mr. Hammarskjöld in a way which is utterly indefensible, proposed the dissolution of the Office of the Secretary General, to strip the United Nations of all powers to develop and initiate programs of action, sought to replace this by a three-man presidium in which the Russians would have the power of veto, refused to pay the Russian share of the expeditionary force pay, plunging the United Nations into a serious financial crisis, and all in all posed a threat to the existence of the United Nations, to its effectiveness, which remains with us at this hour, and a threat which, if unanswered, will destroy the one government in the world which has as its sole purpose the establishment of world order and the easing of international tensions. In New York, Mr. Khrushchev overstepped the bounds of propriety. He angered many nations. He was unsuccessful in passing a single one of his pet resolutions. But as the year closes, the threat remains. Russian obstinacy and intransigence have been embittered. Mr. Hammarskjöld is fighting for his very political life, and the United Nations is endangered of being emasculated so that it becomes like the old League, nothing more than an ineffectual political propaganda sounding board. After the debacle of Paris, it was inevitable that trouble would break out in many parts of the world. And one of the most likely areas for such trouble is the old unsettled area of Indochina. Indochina, bound by difficult ceasefire agreements in 1954. Indochina with small, arbitrarily devised nations, none of which is large enough to be viable, each of which represents an ideological point of view at variance with its neighbors. Laos too, like the Congo, became a crisis in Paris in May. The Laos crisis is much in our minds and in our headlines at this hour. There is the position of our own government. There is danger that the Laotian situation will become another Korea. The analogy here is not exact. In Korea, there was a direct invasion of a United Nations demarcation line by one government into the territory of another. Laos is a country in which the power political situation is not clear. It is a country of small feudal princelings, each of which has his own army, each of which armies has never been demobilized. And each army has continually at battle one with the next. Moreover, the moral of the situation is not clear. The right-wing government of Prince Bun Um, whom we support, is not a popularly elected government. It came to power by force of arms, by revolution, against a neutralist government, which had decided in September and October of this year to welcome aid from both East and West. whether tacitly or overtly, our own government had interfered by its espousal of the right-wing group of Prince Bun Aung in the internal affairs of Laos, and was as guilty of such intervention as the North Vietnamese and the Red Chinese and the Russians whom they represent. It is at this hour still unclear who is fighting whom. This much, however, is clear, that we have here a struggle between competing mercenary armies, one in the pay of the West, one in the pay of the Communist bloc. And it is also clear that America is ignorant of the internal political tensions of Laos, that it need not be a keystone of Western policy to maintain Prince Bun Aung in power. He does not represent, as far as anyone knows, the elected will of the Laotian people. Certainly, as our allies have been telling us, every attempt to settle and to accommodate this issue within the United Nations, if possible, without if necessary, should be attempted before large-scale, helter-skelter military commitments are made by our nation to the present government of Laos, commitments which can not only create another Korea, but which can create the Holocaust we all fear. What of the future? What of 1961? I have painted a picture which is one of concern. And I feel great concern. The lines of communication have almost all been ruptured between East and West. The United States, the Soviet Union, lack the most elementary trust. Each seems to be concerned with the number of atomic submarines it can slip into the water, the number of atomic missiles it can raise on a pad. And certainly all of us know now that atomic missiles and atomic submarines do not make for peace. The voice on which 1960 closes is the voice of Khrushchev, an angry voice, speaking at the United Nations 2 months ago. You want to compete with us in the arms race? We will beat you in that. Production of rockets is now a matter of mass delivery like sausages that come out of an automatic machine. Of course, you are going to complain all over the place, Khrushchev is threatening. Well, he is not threatening. He is really predicting the future. The arms race will go on. And this will bring about war, a war you will lose. Many of those sitting here today will not be found any longer, and not many, but perhaps all. You are accustomed to words that lull you. But as for Khrushchev, I do not with a pat on your head when the world is on the verge of catastrophe. You want to listen to unpleasant words? Well, if these words are unpleasant, that means I have achieved my purpose. That is exactly what I intended. 1960 was a year of unpleasant words and unpleasant actions. Will 1961 be more of the same? There was reason to believe that 1961 need not be. As the year closed, there was some evidence that Mr. Khrushchev recognized that he had pushed the West a little bit too far, that he had not made headway with the neutralist nations in his attack on the United Nations, and that his personal attack on Mr. Hammarskjöld had redounded and given new status and new dignity to this brilliant hero of the last year. You'll recall that in November at the Communist Ideological Conference, Mr. Khrushchev viewed to his old line the necessity of coexistence. There was no longer to be an inevitable war between capitalism and communism, now only an inevitable economic competition between these two competing systems. And he not only stalemated but defeated the Red Chinese and Chuen Lai on this issue. And as the year closed, there was evidence that he was seeking a way out, a way of reestablishing communication between Washington and Moscow. For he had his minions, Mr. Menshikov in Washington and others, speak out on in this vein, that he would not hold the new administration guilty of the failings of the last. But the Soviet Union looked forward hopefully to the Kennedy administration, hopeful that arrangements could be made with it for international peace. And on our side, there was evidence that Mr. Kennedy, like all the presidents before him, was willing to meet with the Soviets, whatever the aggravation, if there was any serious hope of establishing programs of arms control or disarmament or any political arrangement which would relieve international tension. Mr. Kennedy has spoken more than most men before him of the necessity of such arrangements. It is to be hoped that when he comes before Congress and the people in January of this year, he will speak not only of the military budget, but of programs and plans for peace. For there is a new urgency to our search for peace, an urgency which is apparent to the East as to the West. Every political problem which we face in our world will never be free of political tension, is immediately raised to an atomic multiplier, to an atomic level. Every political tension involves Armageddon, the apocalypse, and the final end. And within the next decade, it is certain that the now exclusive atomic club will be an open-ended social organization, political organization, if you will. Imagine a world in which not only Mr. Khrushchev and the United States, Great Britain, and France control atomic weapons, when they are in the hands of Chiu En Lai, Nasser, of Lumumba, Castro. War itself is defeat. The spread of atomic weapons into hands other than those that now possess it makes it infinitely more difficult to arrive at any arrangement to limit these arms, to control them, to keep them in responsible hands. Sir Charles P. Snow, speaking this past week at the New York meeting of the Society for the Advancement of Science, said the simple truth which we've all been trying to escape, that within 10 years, unless there are definite arrangements for peace and disarmament, through malice or madness or folly or mistake, the bomb will fall. And with it, all civilization will fall. Mr. Khrushchev apparently is beginning to recognize this. He's thinking men in our own country. And there is hope, some hope, that there will be in 1961 at least one, hopefully not the last, opportunity for high-level arrangement on arms control, disarmament, and to reduce international tension. I have spoken in the past weeks my own feelings in this matter. I would wish that the United States might take the lead. Oh, we have gone to disarmament tables readily enough in the past 5 years, over and over again at Geneva, New York, and elsewhere. But largely we have brought to these tables a portfolio of propaganda and a mission of mistrust. We've insisted on foolproof inspection systems when our scientists tell us there are no such systems, and when those who propound it know that such insistence is only a dilatory tactic designed to prevent any arrangement. We are now talking of equipping our NATO allies with atomic potential. I have called and I call now for a reversal of this policy. Germany is increasingly the dominant force in NATO. To equip Germany with atomic weapons is to plunge all of Central Europe into turmoil, to assure that the whole Iron Curtain line will bristle with incidents and weapons. And surely, as certainly as we are here, that war will come out of this witch's brew. I have called for a continuation of our present moratorium on atomic weapons testing. We were backed into this moratorium by the unilateral decision of the Russians, but it is the only single arrangement for peace that the great powers of the world have been able to effect. And to destroy this one arrangement is to take a giant step backwards towards the dangers that we fear. I know that there are experts, military experts, within the Atomic Energy Commission and the Pentagon who tell us that we need to test our new weapons. I say that we do not. I say that it is far more important to keep our air clean, keep our hands clean, keep our policies clean in the eyes of the world than it is to develop what is euphemistically called a clean bomb. Finally, I called for a dramatic action on the part of our government, an action which would vouchsafe our sincerity, an action which would say to the world, America is a nation dedicated to peace, determined for peace. The caricature of Uncle Sam bestride an atomic cannon, a caricature which has become more and more prevalent throughout the world, is false. Uncle Sam is what he has always proclaimed himself to be. A nation of free men and of peace-loving men. I called for a moratorium on the construction of all atomic weapons, unilateral, to last as long as the Russians sit down with us face to face in serious and substantial and achieving conversation. I read recently, as I'm sure you did, that we now have a stockpile of 30,000 atomic weapons. The Russian stockpile is equal to ours. Knowing the potential of each of these weapons, remembering that the two primitive bombs that we dropped on Japan destroyed 125,000 people. We'll multiply our new efficiency by 30,000 bombs, and you can destroy the world population many times over. Why do we need a greater arsenal of weapons? Why not seize this opportunity? Tell the world that we earnestly and with urgency, desire peace, feel it's imperative, and are willing to risk for peace. For only if the great powers of the world are willing to risk for peace, will there be peace. 1960, Americans went to the polls in a great national election. The closeness of that election, some 112,000 vote majority out of almost 70 million cast, makes it difficult to assess the mandate which President-elect Kennedy has received. But this much is certain, that Americans of both political parties, of all shades of political view, were determined and are determined that the executive branch of the government reflect the will of the people. Their will that sleeves be rolled up and that the American people united get down to work to solve the many real, vital, urgent, pressing problems which confront us. We can no longer golf our way into the future. We can no longer expect that by the purity of our words, peace is assured, principle is assured, and power is assured. Challenges facing America in 1961 are serious, but there is a new mood of anxious concern, a new willingness to sacrifice apparent throughout the length and breadth of our nation, and the new executive branch of our government reflects that mood, and hopefully with skill, and with understanding, and with leadership, will guide us through the dangerous days that confront us, give to us that economy of abundance, that society of well-being, and that world of peace for which we all pray. Amen.